Today, Lehman Brothers 10 years on, what does it really mean? Hello, I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Today, I'm joined by Robbie Barwick from the CEC, and we're going to look over the last 10 years and ask what's really changed. Hello, Robbie.
Hello, Martin.
Good to see you again, and thanks very much for spending some time with us. So it's 10 years since the GFC really kicked off with the Lehman Brothers falling over. And I know you've been doing quite a lot of work on this and thinking about what does it really tell us. So perhaps we could start with what happened then, and then we can think about what are the implications now.
Well, I think the overall story, the international story, is fairly well known, and thanks to and the public probably has, those who got to see movies like The Big Short would have a good insight into that. I just finished reading the book, and it took me a while to get around to the book, but it's full of excellent detail. So, you know, all the gambling the banks were up to is well known. What I'm interested in, and what we put out in our alert service publication this week, is the story of what actually happened in Australia, because there's a real myth there. And the myth is, you know, Australia escaped the global financial crisis. Our banks were sound. And I remember that refrain at the time so many times, the banks are sound. But we know it didn't take much digging to see that behind the scenes there's a lot of panic. Our banks were in deep trouble. They had to be rescued, and that's the, we put in an article about that, giving the details of that.
So let's look at that in more detail. So we know that Rudd basically corralled a whole lot of actions around, you know, handing out money and the schools program, the pink bats and everything. And the mythology is that's what saved us from the wreckage of the GFC. But as we get the perspective from history, maybe that's not the real story.
No, that's not the real story. I mean, overall, I think you distinguish between the economy and the banking system. The economy was saved by one thing and one thing only, and that's in early 2009. The Chinese announced $1 trillion spending on infrastructure. And without that, I remember the Western Australia, just go look up the state budgets of Western Australia and Queensland, especially early 2009, their revenue had collapsed because our dependence on oil, coal and iron ore exports, everything ground to a halt. There's a great picture you can see of the Singapore port at that time, which was a parking lot of ships. The biggest port in the world is a parking lot of ships. Global shipping had ground to a halt. That the Baltic Dry Index, if you remember that, it had in August, I think, 2008, collapsed by 90%. The index of global shipping had collapsed by 90%. So that's the economy. And it was only from Australia's standpoint, it was only China saying, okay, we're going to start doing this, spending on infrastructure. All the exports started rolling again, and that's what allowed the wheels of our economy to start moving again. Rudd's $10 trillion stimulus was, to me, irrelevant. I mean, kept certain amount of money circulating, but it would not have been anywhere near enough.
So what you're saying there is really that trend triggered the next rolling on of the mining boom. And so we basically exported, you know, stuff from all over the place up to China. And therefore, we had that 5 or 6 years of massive response to the Chinese stimulation.
Yeah, exactly. And but it was, you know, they also did certain things here for the banks that I think have set us up for the position we're in now. When if you're like us and you focus on, you're aware that the biggest threat facing Australia is in our housing market. The threat in our housing market now already existed in 2008. Their actions then made it worse. It's a double the problem, more than double the problem now it was in 2008. And I think, Martin, in 2008, then it was enough to crash our system, right, without these measures. But at the time, none of this was publicly admitted, right? And we've had this myth ever since. So we can go. I've got some predicates on that if you want me to go through them.
Hmm. I think it will be good to get a bit of detail here because, you know, the stuff that's now coming out just highlights how close to the edge our banks were back in 2008.
And I was talking with some people earlier this morning. So Kevin Rudd now is fairly frank about what happened. He talks about You know, they like making it sound really dramatic 10 years later when the dust has settled. They weren't frank at all at the time, right? It was, you know, no, this word sound, I just remember if they said it once, they said it 1,000 times. Banks are sound. Well, here's what we knew about the banks. And we were monitoring this for a long time. We had put, I just recorded an episode of our show yesterday, the CEC report, where we go through some of this. And we put on the screen the publications we were putting out in the years leading up to this. I remember in 2004, one of our publications had an article then talking about how the US housing bubble would lead to a crash. 2004, we said that. In 2005, a headline of our New Citizen newspaper talked about derivatives bubble, what we called it the mother of all bubbles. It would crash. It has to crash. In 2006 and 2007, we had similar headlines. Look, what's happening in the system has to crash. And in fact, in August 2007, our headline was "The crash has started," right? Because that was on the back of Bear Stearns. We have a video that we use where we quote Julia Gillard. We have Julia Gillard, a clip where she's going, "No one 12 months ago was talking about a global financial crisis." Well, we were. It was in our headline of our paper a year earlier, right? But why? Because we were monitoring the predicates that I'm about to go through. So first of all, house prices in Australia, like the United States, had skyrocketed from in the same time frame, from the year 2000 onwards, right? And almost tripled. And the biggest rise was actually from 2000 to 2004, the sharpest rise. You can see that in charts today. And you look at you can look at certain actions that were done in 2005, 2006 to keep encouraging it. You know, like they let self-managed super funds start investing in housing in 2006. These types of measures, they're all designed to keep this market pumped up, right? And now, if what I was seeing on 60 Minutes coming up this Sunday is true, those chickens are going to be coming home to roost in the self-managed super fund department. So we had the same housing bubble as the United States, as Europe, as UK, as Ireland, right? We had the same bubble, but of course it was all denied. We had securitization. It was not as it wasn't at the same rate as the United States. There's by 2008, their level of securitization of mortgages was 50%, according to the former APRA principal researcher, Dr. Wilson Tsai, who has access to these figures. Australia's rate was about 25%, but it was growing fast, right? We were rushing to catch up to the United States, so we were starting to securitize like mad. And then, of course, you know, once you've securitized, who knows where those mortgages are ending up, right? I'm sure they were involved in the same CDO process. We had our own subprime. And the subprime in Australia, I mean, Denise Braley of the Banking and Finance Consumer Support Association, she tends to think, she uses subprime generically. Everything dodgy is subprime. And that's true, interest only, et cetera. But we zeroed in at the time on these low doc and no doc loans. And of course, there's a lot of fraud in them as well. They had started for a reason, just like subprime mortgages had started for a reason. There was a purpose to them. They filled a certain niche. But then these types of mortgages became the vehicle to justify an enormous increase in lending. And the rate of no-doc and low-doc loans in Australia in 2000 was 1%. By 2008, they were 20% of all mortgages. And that's the same rate as the subprime mortgage lending in the United States. They've grown at the same rate. So we had our own problem in that area for sure. Interest rates in Australia had been rising since 2002. Had gone from 4.25%, and by 2008 they hit 7.25%. And as a political party, you know, we're aware of what's happening politically a lot. There's no doubt in my mind the reason John Howard lost the 2007 election was because of the cost of living crisis. That's all everyone was talking about. Rudd announced he'd have a cost of living task force, etc. John Howard didn't just lose the election; he lost his own seat. Because people ultimately vote with their hip pockets, right? It was tough. That was all on the back of those interest rate rises. And I wasn't aware of you then, Martin, but I don't know if you were monitoring the mortgage stress then like you do now, but that was being reported all the time.
Yeah, I can tell you that we had a very significant run-up in mortgage stress up to the point when the GFC hit and rates were cut. So, yep. And in fact, if you look at the long-term rate in mortgage stress, you can see it going up, it then dips down, and now it's back and continuing to trend from where it was previously.
And that's it. It's interest rates and mortgage stress. And but now we've got this other problem where the 10 years later, the house prices are so high and so unaffordable that the mortgage stress is rising even without the RBA cash rate rising, but other interest rates are going up. We saw the same kind of official denial in those days as we see now, right? But we were getting a lot of anecdotal reports. I remember one that caught our attention late 2007 or early 2008, sorry. We're in Coburg in the northern suburbs of Melbourne, inner northern suburbs. Campbellfield, which is just north of us, the Campbellfield Caravan Park reported they were turning away 75 families per night who were looking for cheap accommodation. That's what things were like in that period, right? Mm. So everything was just as on edge here and vulnerable to a big event. And the big event came in 10 years ago today.
Yep. And one of the things that immediately happened was that there was a liquidity crisis in the Australian banking system. In other words, the banks suddenly found that people were taking deposits out, right? And banks internationally were no longer willing to lend to each other because nobody knew whether that bank over there was likely to fail or not. So the whole liquidity question really came to the fore. And so we saw two things. Firstly, we saw the government effectively guaranteeing deposits. In other words, if they fail, we'll refund. That followed steps taken around the world in other jurisdictions. And there was also some support for the banks directly. But the thing that's not understood is that there was a third factor in this which effectively stopped the banks from falling over.
Yes. The third factor was the one that was lied about. And that was, I call it the third guarantee, and it was the Rudd government effectively guaranteed house prices. So the weekend of October 11 and 12, 2008 was crunch time in Australia. The banks had been begging for their guarantees, et cetera, and they announced the formal guarantees, deposits and overseas, and the banks overseas borrowing. And then they announced they're going to triple the first homeowner's grant. But when they announced that was announced as a housing affordability measure.
Yep.
We've got this housing affordability measure. However, I strategically displayed this book behind me, Shitstorm, by Lenore Taylor and David Uren. When that came out 2 years later, you know, they had the Treasury Secretary, Ken Henry, admitting that was the opposite of a housing affordability measure. That was done to push house prices back up. It doesn't get much more Orwellian than that, where the government with a straight face says, we want to make housing more affordable, so here we're going to triple your first homeowner's grant. And it went from $7,000 to $21,000. And in Victoria, the state government here doubled theirs. So if you're in Victoria, you suddenly had $35,000 as a grant from two governments to buy homes. Well, everyone knew what was going to happen, and it did happen. Like, combined with interest rates going down, flood of new home buyers came into the market, and they pushed it up. And that was their objective, to make housing more unaffordable so that they could save, because what did they know had happened? That's what had crashed the American banks. That's what had crashed the Irish banks. That's what had crashed the British banks. They had to stop that from happening here. And we are now paying the price 10 years later for they settled on a tactic that they cannot unwind. They can't get out of. And so we are now, they've kicked the can down the road, and the crash that is going to happen inevitably to the bubble is going to be much worse than if it had have happened in 2008. There was what's very also very interesting, and this needs more attention, but in 2016, Stephen Long on ABC reported the existence of that in 2007, March 2007, APRA had been warned that this would happen by their own internal researchers. It was an internal report which had looked at the lowering of bank lending standards, and it had from lending, they looked at all loans made in 1 month in 2006, and they were able to look at all the data, look at all the inputs, etc. And they knew that the old lending criteria had been changed to a new one, which was much lower, right, a much lower standard. And that report concluded that as a result, the total amount of mortgage debt as of March 2007 was 3.5 times what it would have been under the old standard. 3.5 times, right? So it was effectively identifying a bubble then. It forecast that mortgage delinquencies were on track to hit 7.5%. Now, what's interesting about that is, if you know the Big Short story, Dr. Michael Burry, the first investor in America in the Big Short story to short the market because he was convinced, it's in the movie, actually. That figure's in the movie. He's telling his investors, wait till the second quarter of 2007, defaults will hit 7%, right? It's the same figure. Well, this report forecast we were on the track for that same default rate in Australia, and it forecast that that would cause a housing crash. Overseas investors would stop lending. You'd have a recession. That's what the report warned our authorities then, and APRA suppressed the report. They sat on it. They said this will not be published. And it only came out in April or whatever it was, 2016, in the Stephen Long report. So that's, you know, and it's an outrageous story, the way the authorities have been complicit in propping up the banks, not for our sake. Forget that. I mean, that becomes there's an extortion factor there, right? Oh, we've got to, you know, stop the banks from going under. They've propped up, because they haven't just propped up the banks, they've propped up their speculation in the economy. That's what they've propped up.
And the other point, just to sort of round out that history lesson there, was that the Fed actually ended up providing funds for some of the Australian banks to support their liquidity. And that's the other factor that's not well known.
Oh, hardly anyone knows it. Well, Kevin Rudd admitted that he lobbied George Bush to bail out AIG, because a third of all insurance policies in Australia were AIG was the reinsurer for a third of insurance policies. That strikes me right there as a blatant contradiction to the claim that APRA's prudential supervision had been so world class it saw us through. If APRA's supervising insurance, how could it allow that much concentration of our insurance policies on one entity in the United States, right? So we depended on the bailout for that, but then directly the money that was spent on the bailout, at least $5 billion was borrowed by Westpac and National Australia Bank. And why did they have to? Well, because they weren't sound. They needed that. So if it wasn't for the timing of the Lehman Brothers collapse 10 years ago today, where up until that time, I think this is the most important point of all this, up until that day, the denial, all authorities in the world were in denial there was a problem, right? They had no clue what they were talking about. They knew nothing. And I would say they still do know nothing. They had no idea. Everything they said was wrong. But when that happened, and then AIG was about to go under the next day, they snapped out of denial, flew into action, were able to take all these measures. But in Australia, the government could do it without actually giving up the public denials. They stayed in denial. No, we're fine, right? But behind the scenes, they're doing the same kind of extreme emergency action, an out-and-out rescue of the banks to stop them from going under.
Right. And as you say, a lot of that was not understood at the time. The myth has always been that we got away scot-free because of our own action and because of the very strong regulatory frameworks that we have, and our banks were absolutely fine and sound. But the history now tells a different story, that we were actually very very lucky that we didn't actually end up falling down the hole, as it were. But one interesting thing that springs to mind is, if you think about the fundamental root cause of the GFC, there were two factors that I want to call out. The first was stupid lending for housing in the US. So people who should have never got loans got loans. So they were very loose, fraudulent loans, and effectively the regulatory system not being able to be responsible and effective in controlling poor home lending. So that was the first factor. The second factor was the financial engineering and financial markets that enabled those loans to be packaged up and effectively repurposed and resold around the world, and so connected into the financial system, the financial markets. And those, so those risks were passed around, and basically banks around the world end up with these package of loans, and nobody knew whether that loan was a good one or a bad one. So it was the financial market aspect as well. So home lending was off, and the financial markets was responsible. Now, fast forward 10 years, right? What are the factors that we've got here? The first is that we know from the Royal Commission that home lending is really off. We know that there are lots of people with loans they should never have got. We know that the banks were actually creating fraudulent loans. We know that there was fraud in the system right where they crossed the board. We don't know how much there is, you know, and some people are saying it's really, really high, and some people are saying it's quite high. But the Royal Commission showed that we've got a lot of people who actually should have got loans they should never have got. And you can look at the refinancing numbers. Today, on tighter standards, 40% of people couldn't get that loan. So we know that's the first problem. The second issue is banks here are totally reliant on the international capital markets to support their books. A significant proportion, around 30%, of the bank's books are supported by the international markets. And of that, a significant proportion is on short-term, under 1 year, but a lot of it on 90-day. So again, the banks here are also completely linked into what's happening in the financial markets globally. And of course, interest rates are going up, which is why we saw the interest rates rise locally here. So the very seeds of what happened in 2008 are here now. And that's why I'm of the view that we are facing into precisely the same conditions as the Northern Hemisphere faced in 2008.
No, exactly. And you're not Robinson Crusoe. A lot of people are saying that. William White, the former BIS economist, who was one of the few actual authorities, as opposed to these big short speculators who bet it would happen, but an actual authority who said, look, here's a big problem coming. He's repeating his warnings a decade later. You know, we're in huge trouble again. And I think, you know, so many things are similar. Like back in 2008, the bank's 90-day overseas debt was $440 billion, right? When Lehman's went under, $50 billion of that was called in straight away. Well, today, Australia, like in the national debt figures, you can see that national overseas debt on 90 days is $456 billion. Most of that would be the banks again, because they're the only ones that have that kind of business model. So it's the same, exactly the same stuff. In other words, the things they got the guarantees for to get that kind of exposure down after 2008, it's back again, baby, right? So the vulnerability is there. And then, of course, on the fraud, we've just posted on our YouTube channel a presentation by Denise Braley that goes for an hour. I really urge everyone to watch it. It's called Mortgage Fraud Explained. Do not take out a mortgage unless you've watched this. Denise doesn't go on statistics, she goes on experience. She talks to so many people. She has been an advocate for so many people keep their homes, right? She is tireless, and she can give you the nitty-gritty of how it's worked. It is the heart and soul, unfortunately, of our mortgage bubble. So much is based on fraud. And as Denise says, people always say to her, but Denise, if we make too big a deal of this, it'll crash the economy. And her reply was, well, we've got a problem then, haven't we? Right, that is the nub of the problem today, and that's why, if we have time to get this in, Martin, the CEC's number one policy, to start to address this, it won't completely address it, but start to address this and set us up going forward, is to have a Glass-Steagall separation of the banking system again, so that if the real banking system cannot become collateral for this kind of speculation, and if it can't be. If the speculators and the predators can't have access to the real financial system, that will be cut off with Glass-Steagall. If all their derivatives and all their trading, etc., cannot be based on that, and they're therefore forced to eat their own losses, only that they'll either continue their gambling and eat their own losses, but that won't fall back on us, or they'll realise, well, we better take a chill pill here and rein this in. It's the only way to. You've got to have the Glass-Steagall separation that was in America for 66 years was a break on speculation, right? There was a speed limit on it, that once they took it away, that just went through the ceiling, and that's why we've got to bring that back again. And so this, you know, I'll be in Canberra next week, you know, taking advantage of the fact this is the 10th anniversary, talking to members of parliament. There's a bill in parliament that Bob Catter introduced back in June to bring in a Glass-Steagall separation. We'll be in there talking to them about it. We need this so we have a framework in Australia where we can start addressing some of the other problems in the system.
Yes, absolutely. Well, there are clearly things that could be done and should be done. It seems to me, though, that Canberra is still in denial and the regulators are still in denial, and everybody is worrying about scaring the horses with regard to where we currently stand. And in fact, you know, people have written quite recently from the housing sector to say, well, you know, this tightening of lending standards and the increased supervision needs to be reversed, because otherwise the housing growth that we've seen won't continue. And it's like, do you really want to continue this same trajectory into even greater bubble territory? No, it's time to begin to take a different path. So clearly Glass-Steagall is part of that. Though I think there are probably other things that need to be done, but actually we're still struggling to get our first base in terms of raising awareness of the issues that are actually out there, which of course is why I decided to take the 60-minute challenge. Always an interesting as to what comes out the end of the sausage machine, but at least what we're trying to do there is to highlight the significant issues in the system and call for a different approach from the lenders, from regulators, and from government to try and tackle this. Because otherwise, we are going to end up precisely in the same state as happened in the US or Ireland, where prices dropped dramatically, where the economy took a dive and took a generation, really, you know, 10 years to really to reset. And I find it really fascinating that just a few months before both the US crashed and Ireland crashed, for example, the regulators and the banking supervisors were saying, there's no problem, the banks are well capitalized, everything is really good. And within 6 months, the whole thing had turned pear-shaped.
And that's the takeaway lesson from the crash, that the authorities, that is those in government, those in the central banks, those in the regulators, those in the media, they don't have a clue what they're talking about. And, you know, the end of The Big Short book, Steve Eisman, one of those guys, he got really enraged at the corruption and fraud in Wall Street, because you cannot paper over that. So much of this is not even just misunderstanding, it's fraud. And he said, he had this great quote. He says, I understand why Goldman Sachs would want to say in what happens to Wall Street in the future. He said, I just don't understand why anyone would listen to what they say. And, you know, there has to be a reckoning here. And the first challenge in Australia is we've got to snap our political leadership out of denial. Now, some are, I get to talk to them, some are, but the majority, no, there's a consensus on denial here, just like every other country. And that's what's going to set us up for this. To snap them out of denial and push them to actually, you know, do preemptively solutions instead of waiting for a total chaos before they prepare to look at it.
Absolutely. And it's not easy because, of course, you are effectively leaning into the wind, but that actually is precisely what regulators and, you know, those thinking about this need to be doing. You can't just wait for it to happen and then try and sweep up the mess afterwards, because the elephant's huge and the mess will be ginormous as a result.
Well, don't rely on the regulators. Not only did they suppress that report I told you about in 2007, but in about 2011, APRA shut down its research department. It doesn't do research anymore. I mean, you're thinking, you're supposed to be the guard on the wall here, right? What do you, you know, don't rely on them at all.
So there was one other thing I wanted just quickly to touch on. You know, we've got the Royal Commission and they'll be reporting later in the year. And, of course, they're a bit crimped in terms of what they can say about the regulators. It's one of the reasons why I think that they should have their scope expanded clearly to cover the regulatory frameworks that we have in Australia. But the other observation is that maybe one of the things they will say is that our banks are actually too big to be effectively managed the way they are, and they should be sliced and diced and effectively, you know, reconstructed. And it seems to me that this could be the perfect opportunity to think about some sort of people's bank, right? A different banking structure that effectively is not designed just to maximise profit, but is actually designed to drive the economic engine that we need to have in Australia. Absolutely. I know that you've got some particular perspective on that.
Well, let me give you a predicate on that first. In 1911, Australia set up its Commonwealth Bank as a public bank, and that was called the People's Bank. There was a global financial crisis in 1914, coinciding with the outbreak of World War One. The Commonwealth Bank, its first claims to fame is it stopped the run on the banks. And Denison Miller, who was the governor of the bank, he strategized about how to do this. He put out the message that the Commonwealth Bank, legal guarantee of deposits at the time. He put out the message that the Commonwealth Bank stood behind the deposits in all the banks. And Australia did not have a run on the banks here, whereas if you can talk, you can look up the history of the crisis in the UK at the time. And actually, in the UK, the bank that was the strongest in the UK at the time was the London branch of the Commonwealth Bank, right? So this was when you have, because this was set up, an American had come out here and convinced the Labor Party, his name was King O'Malley, set it up. And this bank, when it was allowed to work properly, it worked a charm. It was brilliant. And it was at its best in both world wars, because under the conditions of war, the private banks did not oppose they knew that it would look unpatriotic to oppose it. Between the wars, though, they did everything they could to sabotage it. And ultimately, that's why we don't have a bank today. But what a public bank does, we call it a national bank, it makes sure that the credit that is there's what we call a physical economy. The real economy has to have a certain basic level of functionality, right? We all need to have food, clothing, transport, shelter, et cetera, and services that provide that, et cetera. And that's why, that's why you have a farming sector. You want to have food security. And if you'd have a farming sector, frankly, you want food security. Well, then you want family farms over corporate farms, because family farms are there to provide local food, whereas corporate farms, they will grow for here or grow for overseas or whatever, right? So, and look at the farming sector in Australia today. That's a huge part of the Royal Commission barely touched on it. There's a real lot of angst out there as a result of it. They've suffered at the hands of the banks more than anybody. And it's not just them. Small business has been, starved of credit, all these types of things. We've got a terrible manufacturing plight in Australia. So in the last 12 months, we've had small business ombudsman call for a small business public bank, Bill Shorten called for a manufacturing public bank. I think even Scott Morrison floated the idea of some kind of a public financing institution for housing last year. Well, let's do it then. Let's have a people's bank that can provide the credit to make sure that there's a basic level of functioning in those things. It can also provide, you can open it up for things like super. There's $2.7 trillion in super in Australia, right? Far more capital than the banks have. They could be encouraged to invest in a bank like this that the government can borrow from to build the infrastructure it needs. Why should all infrastructure be automatically public-private partnerships where there's an assumption that all roads have got to be toll roads with a 12% return for the investors on them, right? So that, yeah, it's great being able to travel on those toll roads, but when you get your bill, right, the productivity of having that quick trip has been taken away by your pocket's been emptied by it, right? A friend of mine just took a truck from one side of Sydney to the other and returned it. It was $120 just to do that, right, a light truck. That's sapping the public. So, you can go back to building infrastructure like we used to with this kind of institution. That's where you get jobs from. There's plenty of infrastructure that's needed in Australia. We always know that. That's where you get jobs from. And so those two things of industry and infrastructure can be invested in by a national bank. Our proposal goes even further. We want to go back to the current structure of the regulators is terrible. Dr. Wilson Tsai has just written a reply to the Treasury, because the Treasury keeps issuing this statement against the need for Glass-Steagall in Australia, and they say there's a high degree of structural separation in the Australian financial system already. He's proven that it's not. He says the only thing structurally separated is the regulators, APRA, ASIC, RBA, ACCC, and because of this separation, so much falls between the cracks. So let's go back to where the banks are regulated by one regulator, and before APRA it was the RBA. We would say before that, go back to when this national bank should also be the regulator of the banks. So at the end of the day, like in World War II, the banks were heavily regulated by the Commonwealth Bank. They never didn't make a profit, though. They always made a profit. But the Commonwealth Bank made sure that they didn't do anything stupid, right? And the financial system worked to serve the economy. And that's what we want to go back to that model with our proposal for a national bank. So we'll be producing legislation for in the not too distant future, because these are the sorts of things we need. You know, APRA, Glass-Steagall provides a framework for a financial system, an important structure, but then to actually get things done and recapitalize the economy to replace with this, you know, there's so much of it is speculation. You've got to get that out of there and recapitalize it. We think you need a national bank to do that.
And the implication of that then, of course, is that banking, rather than being seen as a profit engine in its own right, and remember that nearly half of all dividends currently come out of the financial sector, to effectively being an entity or a series of entities which supports real economic growth in the broader economy. And that's the secret to dealing with how do we deal with the long-term economic future of Australia. Because without it, we're just going to continue to spiral around these huge boom and bust cycles with ever more debt, and we haven't actually changed the trajectory that we need.
No, exactly. Banking is not productive. The economy should be productive. Banking's there to serve that. And when you have a financialized economy where you're relying for all the income from the financial system rather than the economy it's supposed to serve, then you've got a huge problem. That's why in January or February this outfit in London put out a warning that Australia's banks are a global systemic threat just because of the sheer size of them relative to our economy, and therefore a problem there can quickly spread not just in Australia but around the world. So I like to say it's not rocket science, right? It's just recognizing that 2008 should have taught us all that the theories that had justified that in the decades leading up to it were wrong. Economics, unfortunately, is not science. It's passed off as a science. It's not science. In science, if your results don't match your theory, you throw out the theory. The results were spectacularly failed in 2008, but they hung on to their theories. Whereas we say, take the theory away. Let's go back to when can you see the system working? Right, and go back to those institutions. Forget the neoliberal propaganda. A public bank is not socialism. You're not talking about a socialist economy or a capitalist economy. You're talking about one where, of course you want free enterprise. You want that kind of innovation. You want that only that can bring. But the government is responsible for the common good, and there's a certain basic level of functionality that only it can provide, because it's not there to be short-term, et cetera, and you can compare those investments and make things good for the rest of us.
So maybe, just maybe on the 10th anniversary, the sense of the need to change the direction going forward will be strong enough to begin to actually get some different policies coming out of the political bubble, because without it, it's going to be very hard to see how we can address the fundamental issues that we are currently facing.
Yeah, my hope, Martin, is that because in a sense, outside of some people, 2008 was, they say, unexpected, then in the emergency of it and the chaos of it and the crisis of it, they could pull a swifty over everyone's eyes and, you know, just bail out the banks and keep their system going. The next crisis, they won't be able to say that, right? And because in 2008, there was no Glass-Steagall bill in the US Congress to bring it back. Now there is. There has been one introduced every year for the last 8 years. There's a bill there, right? There's a bill in the Australian Parliament. There's people that tried to pass it in the United Kingdom Parliament. So in the next crisis, that will reinforce the credibility of people like us and fighting for these kind of solutions, and will be much harder to resist, and I'm much more confident that we'll be able to get it through.
And it's worth saying, I think, finally, that we need people effectively to write to their MPs, tackle their MPs and all this, because this is going to have to be a bottom-up thing. This is not going to come down from a strategic change of the wind, right? This is going to have to be a community-led program that says we cannot continue to go the same route that we've gone with this massive debt burden and all the risks. But the good news is there are alternatives that are out there, and go on.
If you're a keyboard warrior watching videos like this, etc., do that. Go to the extra effort. Look up your MP on the aph.gov.au website. Look up your senators. Start sending them material. Demand they support Bob Catter's private members' bill for Glass-Steagall. demand they pay attention to the price in the system. The more contact they get from the public, the more they pay attention to it, right? And so do it. And that's where our success has come from in the last 12 months. So I really urge everyone to, you know, don't discount the effect of that, right? Don't say, oh, it won't work, because that's a self-fulfilling prophecy, because then you don't do it. And of course, that doesn't work. But if everyone does it, trust me, I see that I've had meetings where I'm sitting down with members of parliament that have been, you know, bombarded by people. And some of them have said to me, this is a quote, said, what you're doing works. That's why we're meeting you. Right? We got their attention. So it does work. Don't just watch videos like this. You get thousands of viewers. Martin, you know, or if all of your viewers start doing that, right, it'll start making a difference. Trust me.
Hopefully, even those who watch 60 Minutes might be liberated to go and come and have a look and then, you know, communicate. Because we do have an opportunity to get the direction changed. It isn't set in stone yet. It's not immutable. But if we don't do that, then I think the writing is definitely on the wall.
Yep.
Robbie, thank you very much for your time today. I really appreciate it, and I've enjoyed speaking with you. And
thanks, man. Appreciate it too.
Sure, we'll catch up again down the track as these things develop.
All right. Thanks, mate.
Thank you for your time. Bye-bye. Right. If you like what you've seen here today, please like the post. Feel free to leave a comment or a question, and please share it as widely as you can. And if you haven't subscribed so far, please ring that subscribe bell to get alerts for future updates. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Thanks for listening, and I'll talk to you next time.